Many soldiers, before going into conflict, write farewell letters to be sent only in the event of their death. Now on BBC Radio 4, If You're Reading This, explores these letters and the stories behind them, past and present.
He just said to me, if anything happens to me, Mum, he said, I've written some letters.
I don't want any grieving over me. For what better way can a man die than fighting for the people and the things he loves?
I was one of those people who did sit down and write a letter to my mother, in fact.
And it was a very difficult thing to do, because you always think it's...
And that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
Goodbye by Alan Lewis. Died in Burma, 1944.
So we must say goodbye, my darling, and go as lovers go forever. Tonight remains to pack and fix on labels and make an end of lying down together.
Hello, Mum, if you're reading this, then I'm obviously not coming back from Afghanistan.
I can't get my head around, you know, a 19-year-old boy having to write these sorts of things to his parents and to his loved ones and that.
I'm sorry.
Nothing but admiration for the fact that he actually went back to Afghanistan with those thoughts that came inside his head.
It is a little bit like peeling back the curtains on someone's inner thoughts when you read these letters, because they are so personal and they're terribly moving.
Like the creaking beams of a well-stormed sea tub, groaning as the storm beats against her timbers, unwilling to give in, but sooner or later must fall a victim to the tempest.
Bean, I never got to see you, but I know in my heart you are beautiful. I dream of you every night, and I always will. Don't ever think that since I wasn't around that I didn't love you.
Mother, it's a letter which you will only receive in case I shall fall in battle. I'm calm, perfectly serene. I fly away. Free. Free.
It's a bit like those repeated testimonies on 9/11, you know, when they knew they were about to die, they wanted to say to their nearest and dearest on mobile phones or whatever, I love you.
My dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you.
I have no words to tell you of my love for you.
I want all of you to know I love you.
And how my heart yearns to you all.
And when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Sarah. Sarah.
These letters are something tangible that people can go back to again and again, that become treasured.
Mums and dads who receive these letters, it's crucially important to them.
An outlet for lots of things that an individual might not have been able to say in real, normal, everyday life.
The last link with that person.
Dear Mum and Dad, you were right. I should have gone to college.
Lisa Foster, Mum to Robert Foster.
John Foster, Robbie Foster's dad. Robbie was killed in Afghanistan in August 07. Hindsight is such a wonderful thing, but what we know now about Robbie, I wish I'd known before. Never ever give him credit for being the sort of character he was, as big as he was.
There was no army background at all in the family. It just seemed to be an idea that came into his head when he was at school, and it all just sort of snowballed very quickly. From then, within months, he was gone. He was just 18.
It was about halfway through his training, wasn't it, that we started to realise that he was going off to Afghan. And that's when it started getting a little bit more serious, really, didn't it?
Yeah.
Rob didn't say too much, but Lisa and I were getting very sort of concerned.
Yeah, I was very scared. I was scared from the word go.
As the tour went on, I mean, we just so looking forward to getting him home for his R&R, knowing that he sort of broke the back of his tour.
But I did notice a change, and he was very quiet a lot of the time.
He was much more tactile, wasn't he? He wanted to be around us more.
On the middle Saturday when he was home, we had a barbecue and he'd had a few drinks and John had already gone up to bed and we were leaving them to it. And as I was coming back through the kitchen on my way up, Rob was in the kitchen And he just said to me, if anything happens to me, Mum, he said, I've written some letters. And he just told me where he'd left them. I just said, oh, get out of it. And I just sort of laughed it off, really. But I was touched as well at the same time. It seemed to have taken a couple of beers to get it out of him. It had obviously been very much on his mind.
I'm Andy Robert Shaw. I'm curator manager of the Royal Logistical Museum at Deep Cut. Officers, even in Napoleonic times, would write letters before they went into action in the event of their death so that they could be posted to their families. But it comes really to the fore in the sort of mid-19th century, and particularly during the American Civil War, when more soldiers are literate. They actually leave letters or they leave envelopes pinned to their clothing.
Colonel Thomas Broadhead, killed August 31st, 1862. My dearest wife, I write to you, mortally wounded from the battlefield. Before I die, let me implore you in some way it may be stated that General Pope has been outwitted and that McDowell is a traitor. Goodbye, wife and children.
One of the features that you see of battlefields, the American Civil War, is these fluttering bits of paper that very often aren't posted home. They simply blow around the battlefield, a little tragic memorial to a fallen soldier.
See Private Pliny F. White, killed, August 5th, 1863. Dear Lamira, if we meet no more on earth, I hope I shall be worthy to meet you while there will be no parting word. Yours affectionate, Pliny.
Sullivan Ballou, Rhode Island. The First Battle of Bull Run, 1862. My love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me to you with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. I must watch you from the spirit land and hover near you whilst you buffet the storms with your precious little freight and wait with sad patience till we meet to part no more.
My name is Colonel Bob Stewart. I was the British commander in Bosnia, 92-93, and prior to that had served repeatedly in Northern Ireland. When I was in Bosnia, I was warned actually by the Ministry of Defence that my chances of being wounded or killed were 50%. One way of coping with that is to send a farewell letter. In my case, I gave the letter I wrote to the chief clerk. I seem to think it was the chief clerk that suggested it, too, that I wrote a farewell letter, because he said I was a crazy bastard. And at the end of my tour in Bosnia, I ripped it up. You want to put in words how you feel, and, for example, if you have children, that, you know, you want to make sure that they understand that actually you still care deeply about them, even though you're dead. I mean, anyone that writes one of these letters is writing a letter that says, I'm very sorry I'm not there. I wish I was.
These letters are immensely personal, but some of them do end up in archives, National Archives of Scotland, in the Imperial War Museum. We find evidence of people writing letters in the Boer War and then through the First World War when people know there's a very good chance of them being killed if they go over the top. When Tommy comes marching home
again. Padraig Pearce, May 1916.
My dearest mother, I have just received Holy Communion and I am happy except for the great grief of parting with you. This is the death I should have asked for if God had given me the choice of all deaths. The day a soldier's death for Ireland and for freedom.
Private Andrew McNulty, 16th Battalion Royal Scots, 20th of October 1915.
Dear Kate, in the first place, my watch, which I received from my Aunt Rose, shall be given to my niece Rose Mary McNulty. my cigarette case to my nephew Charles McNulty.
I don't think there is anything more I can think about, but you will ask all my friends to think of me at my best, to remember the good of me and forget the bad.
Here is the news. Japan's long-threatened aggression in the Far East began tonight with air attacks on United States naval bases.
And the Japanese are reported to have lost an aircraft carrier and some of their bombers and submarines.
After the outrages they have committed upon us, they must now know that the stakes for which they have decided to play are mortal.
There's a remarkable set of letters written by kamikaze pilots. They know that their death is inevitable and that they have a final chance to say goodbye and say what they feel about the cause they're fighting for.
Yoshi Miyagi, age 22.
A friend said to me that a kamikaze pilot was nothing but a robot. I am prepared to believe it. I am nothing but a robot who works the controls. I must have neither emotions nor personality. The Americans call this suicide, but this suicide is also a form of sacrifice, which can only be understood in Japan, the country of idealism.
Norimasa Hayashi, age 25.
Farewell, father, mother, my brothers and sister. Keep in good health and live happily. I am off to fairyland, and there I shall be a prince. I shall talk with the birds, the flowers, and the trees. May great imperial Japan remain prosperous forever.
I'm Philippa Davis, and I'm a psychologist. I think it could involve a huge cathartic release of emotion to write a letter like this. And it's interesting to think of soldiers doing it, because, of course, they are people who have to have a great deal of control over their emotions normally, and to compartmentalise their emotions, to keep them separate almost from their day job.
We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
My name's Ken Hames. I was a captain in 40 Commando Royal Marines, then decided to join the Special Air Service. I was one of those people who did sit down and write a letter, to my mother, in fact, and it was a very difficult thing to do. You always think it's not going to be me. I was 22 years old, and I wrote it, actually, on the quay side, on a fairly scruffy piece of paper, I remember, and stuck it in an envelope. When you sit down to write this letter, I think the first thing you say is, I'm kind of sorry I've done this to you. I mean, certainly to my mother, I was rather apologetic. And I remember that she planted a rose outside the house, and I remember writing, look, the rose will still grow, you know, whether I'm there or not. But I was pretty philosophical about it at the time. You know, I didn't sit there writing with tears in my eyes. I had too many other things to think about. I don't know what happened to my letter. I never even thought about it again.
It sounded good at the time. When you think about it now, you think, oh, silly. Oh, sort of Hollywood it is. But it really gives you a bit of comfort to think that, you know, you've actually left your feelings behind. My name is Chris Duggan. I served in the Welsh Guards from 1970 to 1986. We were on our way south to the Falklands, and we were on the Queen Elizabeth II. While you're in the army, you have to maintain sort of a false machoism, you know, you mustn't let your emotions show because it's not the done thing, really. And I just felt compelled to write something that if anything should happen to me, then people will know that I'm not bitter. I'm pleased to be there. And obviously the emotions I felt was trepidation, excitement, anxiety, not knowing what was going to happen. It's actually still upstairs now in the attic, and I haven't opened it since 1982. To me, it might be a Pandora's box. It is a bit embarrassing to think I wrote a letter like that.
My name's Rob Nichols, and I was in the Welsh Guards from 1981 to 1993. Yes, you're thinking about dying, but you're young, and you're not really bothered about that. You don't really dwell on it. I just sat on my bed and wrote a few thoughts on there. I was 18 at the time. And mine was more of reassurance for my family, to get on with life, really, not to dwell on me not being there. It was nobody to blame, you know, just to get on with life and not to miss me. My letter actually got burnt on the Galahad. I didn't give it to anybody. I put it in my kit bag, and I thought that if it did happen, it would be found in my kit. But unfortunately, it was burnt on the Galahad.
My name's Neil Llewellyn. I'm a former army chaplain. In olden days, the chaplain helped with the actual writing of it because a number of soldiers weren't terribly literate.
My own darling Mama, I am taking no thoughts for the morrow, but trusting explicitly in Christ, and I know he won't forsake me.
Dear Mother, we are again in the immediate care of God.
If anything ever happens, you will know I was ready for it and went cheerfully and thankfully to meet my
father. I love you, and I entrust the three of us to the providence of God.
Today, but it's helping them to think through what they actually want to say, being a last testament to their nearest and dearest, to their parents, their wives, girlfriends, whatever.
Michael O'Neill, Helmand Province, Afghanistan, 2007.
With a good education, you could become anything you want. Stay away from drugs. They'll ruin your life. Finally, stay away from bad men. Tell Ashley I was sorry. And I'm stupid. And I really did love her.
I was attached to a 3-4 field hospital on the outskirts of Basra in the very beginning. Afghanistan, I was attached to the Green Howards first and with my own regiment then, the Royal Gloucester, Berkshire and Wiltshire Regiment. I suppose in the beginning we were a bit mystified why we were there at all. And there was an element of danger there because of the reports on weapons of mass destruction. We thought, well, if he's got them, he's certainly going to use them against us. But as we know, that wasn't the case. So I think people were generally frightened because that was a real war, if you like, and we didn't know what was around the corner. I know a lot of soldiers did write letters. The couple showed me what they'd written. They loved their wife or their parents and things like that, and not to worry about them, and often questions about the war as well, the legality, the what were we doing, things like that.
Ryan Wood, MySpace blog, 2007.
It is fighting extreme boredom, with the lingering thought in the forefront of your mind that any minute on this patrol could be my last endeavor, only highlighted by times of such extreme terror and an adrenaline rush that no drug can touch. It is walking on that thin line between sanity and insanity. That feeling of total abandonment by a government and a country you used to love because politics are fighting this war. And it's a losing battle. And we're the ones ultimately paying the price.
The problem for soldiers now in Iraq and Afghanistan is whenever you leave the camp, it might be you from the next improvised explosive device. It might be you even in the camp with a rocket that gets through. So you're always on edge in a way that perhaps in previous conflicts that wasn't an issue. You know, you would write your letter before you went over the top. Now it could be you having your breakfast. It could be you just driving out to get to the airport to go home on leave. You're never certain.
US Army officer, Iraq, 2007.
My son, why this day was my last, we'll never know. Why I decided to write this letter is yet another enigma. But I believe there is a reason for it all.
Norma Merrick.
And I wanted you to know that...
April 8th, 2003.
I love you so much, buddy.
Dear Mom and Dad, I can't say I'm not scared. I am. At the same time, I am proud to be a soldier, proud to be defending what I believe in. If I don't get back home, I have some favors to ask. Take my dog for walks. Tell my little brother I love him and not to forget me. My high school yearbooks are in my room, and maybe once in a while you can get them out and look at the silly pictures in them so you will laugh instead of cry. I'm 19, and I sure do miss all of you. Is my old car still in the garage? Take it out once in a while and drive, so our hands will be touching where I held the steering wheel.
In order to grieve, a family needs to be as close to you as possible, and maybe those final thoughts before you go to war are something that could help your family grieve. That's the optimistic way of looking at it. I know it's a pessimistic way of looking at life, that, well, I'm going to die, therefore I'll write a letter, but I think one has to be realistic when you're going into a war situation.
Major Olmsted,
January 2008.
I am leaving this message for you because it appears I must leave sooner than I intended. What I don't want this to be is a chance for me or anyone else to be maudlin. I'm dead. That sucks, at least for me and my family and friends, but all the tears in the world aren't going to bring me back, so I would prefer that people remember the good things about me rather than mourning my loss. If it turns out a specific number of tears will, in fact, bring me back to life, then by all means, break out the onions.
It was here on the front lines of Kajaki that the three British soldiers were killed.
Just we sent rifle that, but we got to see Robbie sort of quite close to, you know, when we actually lost him.
The unit from the Royal Anglian Regiment was patrolling a few kilometres from their base when they came under attack from different directions.
I did have a sense of foreboding, and I wasn't that surprised when I got a knock.
But on this occasion, communication broke down.
The first thing I said to him was, just tell me it's not the worst. And he said, I'm afraid it is.
Yeah, I felt on my knees and it was unreal. I was just sitting there thinking, how can someone get this so wrong? And at that point, I was so consumed with anger, really, wasn't I? I just couldn't deal with it. I just really couldn't deal with the fact that it was the Americans again.
The battle began, and two American F-15 aircraft were called in to provide air support. A bomb was dropped, but in the wrong place, right on top of the British position. Three soldiers died on the spot.
Well, I didn't know that Robert had written the letters. It was the day after that we'd got the news about Robbie that Lisa said there was letters.
Me and John got one each, and my parents got one. I just handed them out.
It was just on an A4 sheet of paper. It was folded up, and I think it took me half an hour, three quarters of an hour to actually open it and read it. I wasn't sure I wanted to read it, but then you're just drawn to read it. I had a chuckle. I cried. I don't think Lucy laughed much. I think you cried quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think your mum and dad had a bit of a chuckle, because there was some funny stuff in theirs as well.
It was like, well, hello, Mum, if you're reading this, then I'm obviously not coming back from Afghanistan. I'm sorry.
But it was virtually the same as Lisa's. But he just said it had gone wrong, he wasn't coming home, and he was sorry. And he also gave me quite specific details about how he saw his celebration. He didn't ever call it his funeral, he said his celebration.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Exactly what he wanted, we followed to the letter, didn't we? We had the biggest celebration. We had probably 500 or so of his friends, family, army turn up. We had local council on board, and we had the street closed with a marquee, and we had a karaoke, because that's what Robert wanted. And everybody just had a party, because that's how Rob would have done it, definitely. And there are many things that I would like to say to you, but I don't know how. Robbie's favourite karaoke song was Wonderwall. I think that's how the night sort of started, all of his mates, and some of his section was up, and they were just all singing Wonderwall and shouting Robbie's name, weren't they?
Sonny, I can read it, but I can't talk about it. It's I can talk about having the letter, but it's very hard to talk about what's in it, because when I was talking about what's in it, I'm seeing him writing it.
That's what gets me.
And I'm seeing him saying it. There wasn't particularly anything in the letter that I didn't know, but it's confirmation. It's proof. I can now go and get that letter out
whenever I want to, and I can read it and I can know the truth.
My letter was very jokey, the way Robbie was. Yeah, he finished it off with a big picture of some bosoms,
yeah,
with a finger pointing, saying, boobs.
With Mama's a bit more lovey-dovey than
that. Yeah, at least I've got hearts and kisses.
Got hearts and kisses.
I've got boobs. My thoughts days after was the fact of just, you know, a 19-year-old boy having to sit in his bedroom and write these letters, you know, what was going through his mind. You know, he was obviously a lot more afraid than I ever gave him credit for, I think.
Mm.
And you try and put yourself in that position, and I just, what do you say to people? You know, if you feel in your heart that where you're going to go, there's a good chance that, you know, it could go wrong, what do you say to people? Just, no 19-year-old boy should have to do that. You know, he should be out with his mates having a laugh. I'm quite happy to know that it's here, but I'm not drawn to read it. At the moment, it's still very, very, very raw.
I do read mine every sort of month or something. I'll get it out and I do read it, and then I tuck it away again, and that is, it's very much mine. I feel no need or urge to share it with anybody. And obviously they're priceless, because, you know, you can have memories of words that have been spoken, but words written down are proof that never goes away. You've got something tangible that you can go and get out and you can read, and you know darn well where you stood. I feel like if something happened to me, I'd want that letter to go with me, because it's mine.
For the Fallen, by Lawrence Binion. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end, against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. As the stars that are starry in the time of our darkness, to the end, they remain.
If You're Reading This featured the voices of Brendan Charlson, Adam Redmore, Catherine Mangold, the poet Paul Henry, and Kwok Yeo Chim. The programme was developed by Siobhan McClelland. The producer was Shan Price, and it was a Tinderbox production for BBC Radio 4. Now let's hear about today's You and Yours from Liz Barclay.
Well, Cathy, tea to India, jam to France, sweets to Slovakia, our food and drink sales abroad have reached record levels. So is it time to celebrate the boost to our economy, or is the picture more complex? And should we perhaps be keeping much of our produce at home? We'll be discussing that and sampling wine from a carton through a straw. French drinkers are fairly disdainful of the idea, so will it catch on here as a drink, perhaps, with a lunchtime snack?